Hello, America, and all of our listeners all over the world. You're listening to yet another exciting edition of Let's Weekend. I'm your host and host, Brandon Perkins. Joining me, as always, is Chris Elogi. Say hi to the good people, Chris.
Hello.
Yeah, so it is December 6th, 2025. We are now officially in December. We are now officially in the holiday season. Because that's how it always is. Christmas gets here. It gets here quicker and quicker the older you get. But among the stuff we'll be discussing this week, we have a couple of things, some decisions that came from the Supreme Court. Well, one of them is decision. Another is bringing something into consideration. We'll be talking about all that. We also have some news about the Inspector General from the Pentagon putting out a Pete report criticizing current head of the Department of War, Pete Hegseth. I hate using that title, but there we go. A major mystery from around the January 6th events may have finally been solved. It's one that's been kind of confounding people for a few years, and it looks like they finally managed to track down the person responsible. Maybe. That's a big maybe, because remember, this is the current FBI we're talking about. And of course, as usual, we also have our entertainment-related stuff, including someone has managed to get the winning bid for Warner Brothers, and it is setting off a bunch of alarm bells. We'll be talking about that. All that and more on this week's episode of Let's Weekend. So, to start us off, as always, we'll talk about, as is tradition, all the stuff we've been doing up to this point this week. And it's also as tradition, we start with Chris. Chris, what have you been doing this week?
Yeah, this has been another cold week for us.
Yeah, no kidding.
We've been under the freezing point for most of the week, which has been fun. Especially because I think we had about 3 inches of snow on Tuesday. I'm not sure what the final tally was, but we had a good bit of snow that was nice to see. I think the big issue was just it seemed like nobody was really ready for it, so the roads were pretty bad driving into work. Yeah. That. And I mean bad in the sense of anybody I saw getting on the road, you could see their tires spinning because they could not get grip on it. And that's a fun whole thing. But yeah, it's mostly melted, but now kind of we're at the point where, you know, the stuff that melts turns into ice and all that, and makes for a fun time walking around in it. So yeah, that's been kind of the weather stuff that's been it may warm up enough to start melting some more of that, though we might also get some rain with that, so that'll be fun. But yeah, for things I've been doing, I have watched Troll 2, the sequel from the Netflix series. It's set in, I think, Norway, where the first one, you know, has a troll show up and do all the fun stuff, and they manage to defeat it by the end. A bit of a fun way. Though the big thing here is that kind of, like, it takes place sometime after that, and the one thing they find out pretty early is that, the government has this troll that they found, like an ancient troll that's kind of propped up in this thing that looks like they're building a Gundam or something. Kind of thing that's very silly. And like, oh, we got this to secure, we got the, because like the whole thing is they're unable to handle UV lights, so you know, the sun and all that. They got all this set up supposedly to keep it from going wild, and then it's, you know, comes to life and their defenses fail and all that. And it's, I guess, an ancient troll in the sense that the story they tell is like a kid's fairy tale of the old King Olaf that has killed all the trolls kind of thing. And it's kind of a, it's just a weird premise here, but I guess this one is supposedly the one that hates all the humans. It kind of deals with all that, so. But they find good ones, and the humans find other ways to take it down and do all that kind of fun stuff, so. Yeah, it's a pretty good one of these. Not too long either. Maybe like an hour or 30 something, so. Not too long. I did watch another thing I found. A movie I've been meaning to watch at some point, Rock of Ages. A musical that came out in 2012 that's set in, I think, 1987. Is the, I think, the one and only Tom Cruise musical, where I was reading up like the wiki after this, and it's like they didn't know that he had, you know, such a good singing voice and all that. He never really used it for much. So they got, you know, he did a good bit of training for this movie. But there's not really any other real big names attached to this, or even like newcomers that would become big names. There's like Alec Baldwin and Russell Brand were in this, as they reveal later on. They are they confess their love for each other as they're running the this legendary bar where the rock bands play and all that. And on the verge of like potentially shutting down, they confess their love for each other in a weird way. And the it feels like the story is running at like 1.5 times the way it should be. So you just run through the story real fast in ways it's like doesn't make any sense. Tom Cruise's character is Stacy Jacks, essentially Axl Rose. Even got the same kind of bandana wrapped around his forehead kind of way. And he's essentially like drunk and passed out for most of the movie. In a way that you're like, this isn't really a character. It's just kind of like a legend of sorts, but he has maybe the weirdest like romantic slash sex scene I've ever seen in a movie, much less a musical. Where he's getting interviewed by a Rolling Stone journalist who then like calls him out on his bullshit. Like the reason why he's about to go solo is because his band is tired of him being drunk and late and missing, you know, meetings and all this shit. That apparently means that he loves her. And they have this weird sex scene where they don't do anything, but like she's like unzipping his pants kind of thing, and they have this weird thing where she gets up on the pool table in her underwear, and he's like flipping her around constantly, and then he gets on the pool table to lay down, and she gets on top of him, and he just flips her off the table. That's just ridiculous shit that's going on here. So you're supposed to like get from this like, oh, they have an attraction for each other, and it's like does not come off that way at all. It's not a very good movie, but they have lots of, you know, covers of classic rock music from the era. With the like the two lovebirds that the are the big focus of the most of the movie. They go through a weird thing where they confess their love for each other, and then they break up because the guy sees the girl coming out of Stacy Jax's room with like her shoulder strap like down, and then he's zipping up his pants as he's leaving because this is right after that sex scene. She just goes to bring him booze and drops it and all that. She leaves in confusion and whatever. And they break up there as he's playing I Wanna Rock. As he's doing his like big debut as a rock musician. And then he gets an offer to sign with whatever he's Jax's manager,
Mm.
and immediately finds out like nobody wants rock music anymore. At least the execs do don't want it, and that leads to him getting recruited into like a hip hop boy band called the Z Boys, with like the tagline being like double the E, double the Z, double the flavor, which is like some very like New Kids on the Block, whatever kind of vibe to it.
Yeah, it worked for the time period, I guess.
Yeah. But it's also like this is really dumb. And the name he has for his band or what he would be is like really stupid. I was like, it's not this, it's like Bismarck Von Colt, something stupid like that. To which the Russell Brand character introducing them is like, that's not it for now. That's what I guess you're called. And yeah, then they have their breakup where everybody gets into a bad place and then they figure their way back and then everything's great. And also you got the mayor of LA, which is played by Bryan Cranston. His wife is doing the crusade against the devilish rock music. And you find out she was a groupie for Stacy Jax's band back in the day, and she got spurned, so she came to be the religious right, kind of fighting back against the music corrupting the city.
Oh, yeah.
All that fun stuff. Lots of tropes, but the story is stupid and it's running at a way that you're like, this doesn't make any sense in any way. But and then the guy as part of the main couple, he's been writing a song that ends up being "Don't Stop Believin'," which is like, oh yeah, definitely you wrote the hit Journey song.
Although oddly enough, that musical is one of the reasons why that song managed to sort of make a huge comeback the way it did.
Yeah, I'm sure the musical is much better than the movie.
Oh, it is so much better than the movie. Like, it's night and day.
It's like this feels like a like 3 hour musical that they decided to make into a 2 hour movie, and so it's just running at such a stupid pace that and none of the characters, none of the actors are able to convey the emotions here in a proper way. It's just like, oh, you two are falling in love because you're supposed to, and these two are the unlikely journalist and music legend that aren't supposed to be hooking up, but do hook up, kind of, not really. That's really stupid. But music was all right. Also, like everybody sings, so like Alec Baldwin sings and he's okay, and Russell Brand is okay, and Paul Giamatti is the manager and he's all right. They don't ask him to sing much, but it's like I don't know if they did some extra work to make it sound better. It's not like auto tuning. Yeah, probably just more asking them, seeing a little of them. But yeah, that was all right. But yeah, that's been pretty much what I've been watching. For what I've been playing some more Clair Obscur. I'm trying to get more into this game. I got through the whatever the what called the Gestrels. These were little dudes. There's like an initial area you're getting to try to find them, and you go through like a maze. Which I used a guide to kind of figure out where all the extra stuff was in that. Otherwise, it seems like it's pretty easy to get lost in. Then I got to the Gestrel Village, and it has a bunch of stuff to do there. I'm trying to figure out like what is stuff I can do now, and which is stuff I can do later. Because there's like one guy that wants you to beat him in one punch, hit like 9,999. Points of damage. And I'm like, I don't. The guide's like, you need this, this, and this. And I'm like, all right, this is too much. I don't want to think about this much. It was also like, this is only if you want to do it the first time, versus coming back later when you've built up stats and all that to do that much more easily. But yeah, not doing Not doing too bad, just about to do the tournament thing that they have there. Because you can't get approval to go to the next area without showing them that you're tough. That's beating all their stupid fucking robots they essentially made. Ones that all of them just crash into you after you beat them. You have to dodge them one last time. So yeah, that's been pretty much what I've been doing. So how about you, Brandon?
Well, as for me, I've been taking advantage of my PS Plus subscription, and I have been playing Neon White, which I've played a little bit of already. Like I played a bunch of it back in the old days on when it was like on God, I can't remember what I played it on, but I definitely played it and greatly enjoyed it. I just didn't get very far in it, but this time I'm, making a point of like not only just trying to get like a gold medal in each one of the courses, but also actively getting all of the various gifts and stuff that you that are hidden everywhere so you can further the story a bit. But yeah, that game is incredibly enjoyable. How they managed to take sort of the idea of like speed running and like making it seem so intuitive, like it doesn't feel unfair like at all at that in this game. Like every single one of these levels are so incredibly fine-tuned and well-designed that every single, it's like you feel a lot more powerful than you actually are because the game kind of sort of tricks you a little bit by sort of just very gently adding just a little bit, like it's you don't really notice it until you've done it a bunch of times. The game kind of has something like auto aim, but it's not very obvious. It's more like based on like movement and what weapon you're using and like what direction you're going in. But it is incredible what that game can do. And it's just a lot of fun. And it's funny too. That's the other thing. It's like genuinely funny. It has like a really cool story going along with it. But also on top of that, I've also been playing Baldur's Gate 3 again. I'm once again going through the underground area with the mushroom people, going through all of that. I forget one of the things about that game that I think a lot of people don't realize is that there's like entire sections of that game you might end up miss completely depending on where you're going and what your overall goals are. 'Cause like it is completely possible to completely like bypass that entire underground area if you want to. Like it's not really required to go there. And I like that's the reason why that game still has, wheels, because it's just so well made. And people to this day are still finding stuff that they didn't think was possible you could do in that game. And remember, this was like Larian Studios. They're not a particularly large studio, and they managed to just create this incredible game. I don't, it's just, it's crazy. But yeah, so that's as far as what I've been playing as far as games are concerned. I've been doing, books, reading, nothing new there. And really, the only other thing is it's just like been really cold and wet out there. It's not just been cold, it's also been rainy, which is kind of what ends up happening at this time of year. Because we don't really get snow that much. Instead, we just get hit with a lot of really cold rain, which sucks. But yeah, that's what I've been doing. So, anything you want to add before we move on, Chris?
Nope.
No? Alrighty then. Well, in that case, it's now time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's random let me try that again. And now it's time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's random factoid. And this week I wanted to talk about well, it's on the subject of demagogues. Now, in the modern era, we have no shortage of demagogues, especially on TV. There's this entire genre of on television and on the internet of this entire genre of TV shows, talk shows, and podcasts about that are hosted by very cynical, very loudmouth individuals who really love to like rile up a crowd and really like to sort of permanently exploit people's anger just to keep the money flowing in. And this is not necessarily a new thing in the United States, as far as like, get people getting on the airwaves and creating a following through demagoguery. Way back in the Great Depression, there was a Catholic priest by the name of Father Charles Coughlin, who became notorious for his highly like anti-Semitic sort of pro-fascist rhetoric, before he was eventually like recalled to Rome in I think the early 40s. He was infamous for, going on to his program, and keep in mind this was like on the a radio thing, so this guy was in millions of homes, and he was like one of the most popular radio programs that existed at the time. Basically going on and on about the evils of, Jewish financiers and, all this other stuff. He would start going on about supporting the policies of fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. He w his channel was eventually his show was eventually canceled in 1939, and then the Archdiocese made him stop his newspaper and everything, and he basically had to retire. But that's not quite what we're talking about today. We're going a little bit further into the timeline, into the 1980s. And by the 1980s, there was this new thing that was sort of evolving in the world of filmmaking. What we it's been in television, and it has a couple of names. People have called it the tabloid talk show. Others have called it trash TV. And it involves, people that are, some of the more notorious individuals, like, in the modern era, we think of people like Jerry Springer or Geraldo Rivera. Or then there'd be like Montel Williams, Ricky Lake, those types of groups. And then, of course, Maury Povich famously has his little thing. But there's a sort of like sort of split off kind of thing that goes with it, which is a type of exploitation trash TV that was typically used to push a very crass, vulgar, yet politically and socially conservative agenda. And probably the most infamous of this, like before, you had individuals like Sean Hannity or Glenn Beck or Tucker Carlson or any of these other guys. You go all the way back to the mid to late 80s, and there was a gentleman by the name of Morton Downey Jr. Now, his show actually only ran for a very short time. It only ran from 1987 to 1989. But what he did in that short amount of time was to create a kind of formula that ended up not only sort of being one of the major foundations for trash television, but also being the foundations for a lot of the sort of political demagoguery you see on modern talk show televisions on various news programs. So basically what you need to know first is, of course, about who Morton Downey Jr. himself was. He was a talk show host, actor, and a wannabe singer, who was the son of course, Morton Downey, who was a popular singer and entertainer from the early 20s and from the 20s and 30s. And he was a, this Morton Downey guy, he was a very big deal. He was called himself that he was nicknamed the Irish Nightingale. He famously had a very sort of high-timbered Irish tenor that he had a really good like vocal range, and he sort of became like the toast of both the entertainment industry and also of high society. His personal life, however, was a little rocky, to say the least. He was married to a woman by the name of Barbara Bennett, who had to put her promising dancing and acting careers to deal with the children that they produced. Morton was one of them. He was one of five children, four sons and one daughter. And if you were to listen to Morton Downey Jr. himself, he was, him and his father had kind of a rocky relationship. And he was kind of struggling to sort of get, to fill his father's shoes and to sort of gain his approval, even after he had passed away in the 60s. Downey himself, he spent a long time originally trying to be a singer like his father. He famously appeared on a television show in the late 50s that included luminaries like Dean Martin and such, talking about his talent and everything. And basically Dean was like, you're all right, kid, but you still need a little bit of work and a little bit of more work baking in the oven. And Downey kind of took that to heart, and he just kind of felt like he failed. So he spent most of like the 70s in 60s and 70s working as like a program director and a disc jockey and announcer at various radio stations. And then in the 1980s, he became a talk show host at KFBK AM in Sacramento, California, where he started essentially just doing this really abrasive style. And it wasn't exactly a new kind of thing. In the 70s, especially when local public TV was like really taking off, there were a couple of like these oddball type of sort of, kind of sort of like conservative talk shows that had like a studio audience, and they tended to have like a lot of yelling. They tended to focus on like really abrasive, controversial topics to like get ratings and everything. And essentially what Downey ended up doing is he started to mimic that. But he was fired in 1984. And famously enough, you know who ended up replacing him? Rush Limbaugh. No joke. He then did a stint at WMAQ-AM in Chicago. And then finally, in 1987, he started hosting his own sort of public access local television show, the Morton Downey Jr. Show. It was originally a local program that was specifically limited to WWOR, which was the superstation for the states of New York and New Jersey. But it became so notorious that by the next year, it had already entered into national syndication. And what Downey would do in these shows is notorious. He was constantly would be screaming at his guest, at his audience members. He famously was yelling like at the top of his lungs the whole time. He had a large silver bowl that he would use as an ashtray, and he would like chain smoke through the whole show. Notoriously, he would blow smoke in his guests' faces. He started like these catchphrases. Probably his most notorious was the catchphrase "Zip it," which sort of became like a popular slang thing in the late 80s. The one thing he really loved to do is generating conflict between his guests. One of the most notorious examples of this happened fairly early on in the show's history. It involved two major civil rights activists, Roy Ennis and the Reverend Al Sharpton, and it happened in the context of the it's I'm trying to remember, because this was like this really yeah, here it is. It happened in 1988, during what was called the Tawana Brawley case. Now, Tawana Brawley, for those of you who don't know, she was this African American woman from New York who became infamous in November 8, 1987, at age 15, when she falsely accused four white men of kidnapping and raping her over a 4-day period. The discussion got so brutal that they started literally fighting each other. Roy Ennis ended up pushing Al Sharpton over the chair and off of the platform that they were recording on, causing him to fall to the floor. They then started punching each other and hitting each other with chairs. And Downey Jr. himself just decided to, like, told him, keep filming, keep filming. This is great television. He also would, like, bring in, like, controversial rock stars and sort of lambast them to their faces over their supposed moral degeneracy and how they were poisoning the youth of America. He once notoriously had then libertarian presidential candidate Ron Paul show up, where he yelled at him for wanting to liberalize America's drug laws. And all of this stuff. After that, he also did like a whole episode on, like, gun control and stuff. You know how that goes. That said, and this is sort of the unusual thing, the thing about Morton Downey Jr. was he wasn't necessarily. There were times when you were wondering, like, was he really as conservative as he claimed to be, or was he genuinely just trying to cause conflict? Because there's one example during his show when the topic of the so-called welfare queen came up, and Junior Downey himself said, and I quote, "I'm as far to the right as anybody, but I got to tell you, the whole welfare queen thing is a myth. It's not true." And keep in mind, this is like 1988 we're talking about. So, like, we now know, of course, in the modern era, yes, obviously that whole welfare queen thing was in fact not true. It was always a myth. But he was like in 1988 during Reaganite America being like, yeah, it's not a thing. And then, like, after that, he started, like, one of the big issues was that midway through the show's history, and kind of one of the reasons why it eventually ended up getting canceled from syndication, was because after, like, the sort of reputation the show got about, being sort of a place of, like, crazy violence and vulgarity, a lot of the, like, more famous guests you'd want to get on these shows started refusing to come, so they had to start focusing on more prurient topics like, strippers and sex workers and porn actors and stuff like that. And eventually it got to the point where, like, just the show just it became literally the epitome of what, like, the Jerry Springer show would eventually become. Like you said, even by that point, the show already had, like, a bad reputation, and it didn't have a very good reception with TV critics at the time. David Letterman was once quoted as saying, "I'm always amazed at what people will fall for. We see this every 10 or 12 years, an attempt at this, and I guess from that standpoint, I don't quite understand why everybody's falling over backwards over the guy." Unfortunately, the ratings just kind of could never stay high enough to continue justifying its syndication. I mean, it ended up going through nationwide, but it just could never managed to get it. And when the at last the sort of the change his show to a weekly offering came in 1989. Like 75% of the stations that were airing his show did not renew their contract. So, after that happened, he tried a couple of different times to sort of, work with his apparent pop culture celebrity. He started making appearances on Saturday Night Live. He was at WrestleMania 5. He had roles in Predator 2. He makes an appearance in Revenge of the Nerds 3: The Next Generation. He made a bunch of TV appearances, like on Tales from the Crypt, Counter-Strike, The Raw Truth. He also released an album in 1989 that did okay. But sort of the final straw for what ultimately ended up being the end of everything happened in late April 1989. According to Downey, he was involved in an incident at a restroom at the San Francisco International Airport in which he claimed, and that's the important thing there, claimed to have been attacked by a group of neo-Nazis who painted a swastika on his face and attempted to shave his head. Now, almost immediately, there were inconsistencies with this story. The swastika, or what he claimed was a swastika, was painted in reverse, which would suggest that he had drawn it himself in a mirror. Supposedly, the wounds that he suffered probably came from him intentionally banging his head on the sink in there, and that they believe he ended up doing the shaving on his head himself. So it's largely believed that it was just a ploy for attention. This, of course, was followed shortly after with his show's cancellation, and pretty much all of its like revenue at advertisers had been reduced primarily to direct response ads, you know, 900 numbers, in other words. And then he had to file for bankruptcy the following year, and that was basically more or less the end for him. He tried to make a few restarts where he would be like he tried to start a show on CNBC called Showdown. Then he tried to do a couple of talk show shows on radio in Washington and then Dallas, where he would scream at his callers. And he was also hired as the VP of operations for that last channel. And he did try to make one last attempt in 1997 on Cleveland radio. Didn't really work. And unfortunately, it was also around that time that he was dealing with two issues. One was he was pursuing legal action against Howard Stern because he claimed that Howard Stern had been spreading rumors that he had started smoking again. And there's a reason why he was really sensitive to that because, as it turned out, a couple of years earlier, he had been diagnosed with lung cancer. Like I had been saying earlier, dude was a chain smoker for most of his life. He actively, restricted against he actively fought against, anti-tobacco legislation, claiming that, it was just, more government overreach, that tobacco isn't really that dangerous. Sadly, as we all know, smoking really is that dangerous, and it not only affected his lungs, it also affected his throat and his esophagus. He made one last public appearance in 1997, shortly before his death, where he went before a congressional hearing on the dangers of tobacco, basically giving his testimony, barely able to speak over the grumbling of like the throat surgery he had to undergo, and he passed away shortly after. Ironically, of course, although Downey's whole thing was very short-lived, he ended up sort of giving a voice to what ended up becoming more or less the modern thing of conservative talk radio. I mentioned how when he was fired from his first major radio job in California, he was replaced by Rush Limbaugh. Well, Limbaugh basically took Downey's entire shtick and remade it in his own image. Everything from, the vulgarity, the abrasiveness, the use of dog whistles and offensive humor, the fact that much like how Downey had a nickname for his fans called Loudmouths, Rush Limbaugh had a nickname for his fans called Ditto Heads, all of that stuff. And of course, also, much like Downey, Rush also had his own talk show for a while, although his was more of the sit-down variety. But yeah, that was the life and career of Morton Downey Jr., one of the most, a man who was only in the major spotlight for a short time, but the impact he ended up having was a very, very, ended up being far more effective than we all kind of wished it was. And that has been yet another installment of Brandon's Random Factoid. All right, so with that, it's now time to move on to, the show proper. And as always, with the show proper, we talk about our assholes of the week. And our first major assholes of the week are the Supreme Court of the United States, because they are allowing Texas to go ahead with their gerrymandered maps for the 2026 midterms.
Yeah. Not a surprise that they would allow this, even though it's it was shot down over racial gerrymandering, which was, you know, seemed likely. Yeah, that's not great. But yeah, the Trump supporting justices are the majority, and so they're gonna do whatever he wants, it seems like, at this point. So yeah.
Yeah. And I'm trying to remember, is this like this gerrymandering supposed to be a permanent thing?
Maybe. If it works, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. Because I had heard like it was something they were only gonna do for the 2026 midterms or whatever, but this is Texas we're talking about, so they could. We'll find out, I guess. But also, yeah. On top of all that, they also decided they've also going to decide whether Trump's birthright citizenship order violated the Constitution. Now, you would think that would be pretty easy and open and shut, because they got a bunch of precedent to work on that says, yes, it is definitely unconstitutional and it's in the Constitution, blah, 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 but...
Yeah. It is the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court doesn't have the ability to nullify amendments. But you never know. Considering what they've been doing consistently here. Yeah, they're hearing Trump's appeal of a lower court ruling that struck down his citizenship restrictions. They have not taken effect anywhere in the country. This will be argued in the spring, so... Maybe not. Not going to hear anything about this until the summer.
So yeah.
At least you got
at the earliest.
Some downtime until then.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there you go.
And then we move on from them to, well, the major asshole of probably the century. Because he's been, for whatever reason, I don't know what wild hair got up his ass this week, but he's been talking shit about the Somali community in Minnesota, calling them garbage, claiming they're destroying the country.
Yeah. It was because he hates Tim Walz.
Yeah.
And Minnesota's been one of the more open to you know, Somali refugees as well as others. Minnesota has the biggest Somali community.
Yeah.
So he took to talking shit about them constantly. And Thanksgiving, he called Minnesota a hub of fraudulent money laundering activity. He was terminating temporary protected status for Somalis in Minnesota, which is a legal safeguard against deportation for immigrants from certain countries. Then on Tuesday, the following Tuesday, he said at a cabinet meeting that he did not want immigrants from the war-torn, you know, Somali country to stay in the U.S. We can go one way or the other, and we're going to go the wrong way if we keep taking in garbage into our country. Then followed up Wednesday saying Minnesota had become a hellhole because of them. Somalians should be out of here. They've destroyed our country, which is like... No, they have not done any sort of thing here. But also you got Ilhan Omar, probably the most well-known Somali immigrant in this country. Who's a big star in the House of Representatives. But yeah, ICE is planning on various sort of operations in Minnesota this past week, and probably for the next few weeks at least. But yeah, this is one of their whole things, and they are very much trying to use this fraud thing, which I don't know where that's a big deal. Why it supposedly relates to the Somalian community there. But yeah, as Republicans are seemingly wary to support this because, you know, it makes them look like racists, which is kind of what Trump is being. Pretty openly with all this. Yeah, Tim Walz defended him, saying demonizing an entire group of people by their race and their ethnicity, a very group of people who contribute to the vitality, economic, and cultural of this state, something I was hoping we'd never have to see. This is on top of all the other mild comments. The Republican Minnesota House Speaker, Lisa DeMuth, who's running for governor, said she hopes to win Trump's endorsement, but had to hedge her commentary on this stuff, saying, in no way do I believe any community is all bad, just like I don't believe any community is all good.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to do is call the fraudsters in any community accountable for their actions and stop it here in the state of Minnesota.
Mm.
The manager's like, well, I don't know about the Somalis being bad, but there are fraudsters amongst them. And it's like, yeah, it seems like the bullshit they would do. And here, GOP State Senate Eric Pratt, who's running for the suburban congressional seat being vacated by Democratic Rep. Angie Craig. Well, further saying, it wasn't said the way that I would have said it. What I will say is I share the president's frustration and the amount of fraud and corruption that's effectively gone on in the state. I mean, it's really put a black eye on the state. We are on the national news for all the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have people in Ohio speaking up about these attacks because we have the second largest Somali community in the country. Rep. Terrence Upchurch, president of the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus, saying our Somali neighbors deserve to live in a state where they are respected for their contributions and not singled out by divisive commentary. The Ohio Jewish Caucus said in a separate statement here, President Trump's comments about Somali immigrants are xenophobic, dangerous, and wholly unacceptable from any public official, let alone the President of the United States. So, there's at least some groups willing to speak out against his bullshit. And hopefully, the Somali immigrants in this country don't suffer as a result of this bullshit.
I hope not. But fortunately, it's not all terrible because we do have Heroes of the Week. And this here, our Heroes of the Week are a grand jury because they have once again rejected another attempt to get one of President Trump's political enemies to be charged. And this time they rejected an attempt to get a mortgage fraud indictment against Letitia James.
Yeah, Letitia James.
Letitia James, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, this time around, previously they had the indictments against her that ended up getting thrown out because of the prosecutor in the case.
Mm-hmm.
They tried again here, I assume with somebody else, and just had the them thrown out or denied here, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
This is all just political bullshit here, so hopefully she can see some peace for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? I'm sure they'll keep trying.
Mm-hmm.
But there you go.
Yeah.
Good news, at least.
But it's like once again, like they are so incompetent that they can't even. This isn't even the first time, I think, they've tried to get a bunch of charges on both her and on, you know, others, and, you know, and it's just like it keeps failing.
Yeah.
But anyway. Anyway, moving on. We're moving on from the show proper to the proper show proper. And this week, we unfortunately have to say goodbye to Mr. Cary Hiroyuki Tagawa, the actor who most of our generation will probably remember him as the man who played Shang Tsung in the Mortal Kombat movie. And became so iconic that eventually they just had him play Shang Tsung in the video games, too.
Yeah, at least in Mortal Kombat 11.
Yeah.
Where they were doing basically all the fan service they could.
Yep.
But yeah, an actor who'd worked in the in Hollywood for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Was kind of probably cast in sort of typecast roles because he's Japanese American. Where he's in a bunch of movies here where you can look at them and be like, oh, this is, you know, a Hong Kong style movie or something. Mm-hmm. The Japanese or an Asian actor to be the bad guy, and he was one of them. Yeah, his first appearance was in Big Trouble in Little China as sort of an uncredited role.
Yep.
Which,
by the way, anybody who's never seen that movie, watch it. It's a great movie.
Yeah. Was in stuff like The Last Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
Twins. as Oriental Man, in case you didn't know
Yeah.
the time that movie released in. Which is like, oh, we need an Oriental Man. Get this guy. Yeah, The Last Warrior, License to Kill, Kickboxer 2, Showdown in Little Tokyo, The Perfect Weapon, you know, all these kind of movies are like, yeah, this seems like some movies where you're expecting people to have some martial arts fighting and all that kind of stuff, which he fits into. Then he started getting better roles. Rising Sun, yeah, Mortal Kombat 95. Probably gave him a good platform from there. He's still doing stuff like, you know, Soldier Boys with a Z, because that's how stupid we were. White Tiger, The Phantom, you know, one of the good early comic movies that people like. He was technically in Mortal Kombat Annihilation, but only as archive footage. He was not physically in that movie. But yeah, there's just a bunch of stuff here. He's in Pearl Harbor, which makes sense because you need a lot of Japanese actors in that.
They basically got all the ones they could get.
Yeah.
Like Mako is in that movie. You know, it's like
And
they got
then
all the Japanese and Japanese American actors they could muster.
he capped off a not great year there by being in the Planet of the Apes movie, the Tim Burton one. And he's also in Elektra in 2005. So there's some not some great ones. Balls of Fury, that weird ass movie, is Mysterious Asian Man. And then Tekken is a Heihachi Mishima. I think played that same role in the sequel several years later. But got some better stuff here. 47 Ronin, Kubo and the Two Strings. I feel like if he was able to get into voice acting, that would have been a better place for him, but didn't seem to get a ton of those. He also did a bunch of TV work. He's got a lot of bit parts in a lot of these shows, which seems like a pretty cool place for him. But yeah, and just a bunch of random stuff here. He's in Baywatch a couple times. Babylon 5. Let's see. Yeah, Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Had a random episode there. Netforce, the Tom Clancy show, that sure holds up really well. And this is where he starts doing a lot more voice acting in TV shows like Teen Titans, Trouble in Tokyo. I was in Hawaii Five-0 for a couple episodes, but I guess his main role, main TV thing he did was The Man in the High Castle for Prime Video. He was in the main cast there for a handful of years. But yeah, did some other random stuff. DuckTales, Star Wars Rebels, yeah, the TMNT show from 2012, Star Wars Visions, Blue Eyes Samurai. So yeah, a lot of interesting work here. Outside of Mortal Kombat 11, he was did a little bit of stuff for Warcraft Legion, Batman: Rise of Sun Tzu. He was the titular Sun Tzu. Oh, they did a video game version of Soldier Boys, so of course he was in that. So yeah, there you go. A lot of fun work there, I'm sure. You go watch a lot of that stuff. It's probably not great cinema, but it's probably fun to watch
Oh, yeah.
in a very dumb way. So yeah. But he had an interesting life. I think from what I saw, he was born in Japan to I think it was a Japanese woman and a soldier, an American soldier. He also has, I think, Russian. He's multilingual. He spoke Russian, Korean, Spanish, as well as English and Japanese. Was sort of an army brat kid, so moved all across the country and all that, and then got into, yeah, karate. Studied kendo and Shotokan karate. Yeah, I got into acting through a bunch of bit parts and such, so that's cool.
And really, his portrayal of Shang Tsung is still like, it was incredibly cheesy and over the top, but damn, it was so good.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, but yeah, goodbye, Mr. Tagawa. You left some good movies in your wake. But moving on from there, we now go on to our first story for the night, which is the Pentagon's Inspector General has put out a report that criticizes, well, I mean, that's putting it lightly, Pete Hegseth for putting troops at risk with his signal chat fiasco.
Yeah.
Which is like, it's like that story is somehow, you know, that was months ago, and somehow it's the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, they do have the whole file here.
Mm-hmm.
84 pages of this report, and a bunch of it's, you know, classified information, so it's blocked off and all that, but you can see a lot of it here. But yeah, basically, claim that he, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth put U.S. troops at risk by sharing sensitive plans about an upcoming military strike in Yemen on his personal phone.
Mm-hmm.
That criticized the use of unapproved messaging apps and devices across the Defense Department. Which sounds like, let's say, the things they accused Hillary Clinton of.
Because
She had, two Blackberries? She needed one for her personal use and her government use instead of figuring it out to separate that stuff. She had to mix them up in a dumb way. But here, he had the authority to declassify the material he shared with others in a signal chat, but it said the release of sensitive details about the strike on Houthi militants violated internal Pentagon rules about handling sensitive information that could put service members or their missions in danger. The report noted that the information that Hegseth sent, the quantity and strike times of manned U.S. aircraft over hostile territory about 2 hours to 4 hours before those strikes, created a risk to operational security that could have resulted in failed U.S. mission objectives and potential harm to U.S. pilots. If this information had fallen into the hands of U.S. adversaries, Houthi forces might have been able to counter U.S. forces or reposition personnel and the assets to avoid planned U.S. strikes. Basically, he should not have been doing any of this. And as much as he claims he cares about the troops, he doesn't. Yeah, we didn't have it in here, but they were sharing the footage of the first of the strikes on these supposed drug boats, where they destroyed it, but two people were left alive, sort of clinging to the boat, and then they fired another set of missiles to destroy that and kill them, and showing off that footage. And you can definitely tell who gives a shit about the military procedures and such, what they're not supposed to be doing here, which is, you know, not be judge and executioner on supposed criminals, just killing them without any sort of trial or anything. But they've also been doing that probably at least a dozen times now, so fun times. I don't know that anything's going to happen here. In a normal world, you would have to resign in disgrace after this report. If there was a Democrat with this sort of stuff on here, they would force them to resign. They probably would resign. So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. So there's that crazy shit. And then we got this crazy story. The FBI arrests a man that is being accused of placing the two pipe bombs in D.C. the night before January 6th. So, the sort of joke about this for a while was that a lot of people had been joking that the person who did the pipe bombs was actually Marjorie Taylor Greene, because, one, because of the shoes, and also because of the sort of weird sort of gait that the person had with walking. But they believe they found the guy who did it, and you'll never guess why.
Yeah, this guy supposed to confess to it through all this. And they managed to arrest him. Which is just weird timing, considering, you know, this is, it seems like he did not really hide too well. They say here they reviewed credit card purchases of pipe bomb components, cell phone tower data, and a license plate reader to zero in on this guy. The FBI and Justice Department declined to elaborate on what led them to the suspect, but characterized his arrest as a result of reinvigorated investigation during the Trump administration and credit a fresh analysis of already collected evidence and data. Yeah, they're saying there was no new tip or anything that led to this. No new witness, just diligent police work, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is weird because then they started getting into like the politics of this person. He's a Trump supporter.
Yep.
And all that, so yeah.
Yeah, and it's like it's been weird to see because, you know, you had someone like Jeanine Pirro having to go up there, you know, who had been, you know, essentially, you know, hyping up, you know, election denial stuff, and here that ultimately led to the kind of thing that was the January 6th thing, and now she's having to go on television saying he was disappointed with the results of the 2020 election. It's like,
yeah,
it's hilarious. Moving on to there to something that's not funny. The state of Florida is now starting the process of redistricting for the 2026 midterm elections. This is becoming a pattern.
Yeah.
Because they all are basically betting that they're going to get absolutely shellacked next year in the midterms, and they're doing everything that they possibly can to mitigate the damage.
Yeah. So yeah, they kicked off the first meeting of its Select Committee on Congressional Redistricting on Thursday. So they're starting the process. I don't know if they're going to keep going forward with this. It seems like there's a bit of a divide in the GOP, the Florida GOP, on how the process should move forward. Yeah, their season, their session for this would run from January 13th to March 13th, so few weeks away for that for yeah the chair of the committee Republican state rep Mike Redondo saying it would be irresponsible for the citizens of Florida to wait until next spring as you know Ron DeSantis has called for he declared that any map drawing in Florida would not be done for partisan gain. A pledge that drew loud laughs from the crowd, largely made up of progressive protesters and voting rights activists or advocates. Work as a committee and as a legislative body is not directed by the work of other states or partisan gamesmanship, which also drew laughter. So yeah, people at least showed up for this to see what was going on here. But yeah, somebody here who traveled more than 300 miles from Naples, Florida, to attend the meeting, describe the proceedings as death by PowerPoint. As a very boring meeting, I guess. It's maybe what they want to try to bore people to stop paying attention to this, and then they do the thing they want to do here. So yeah, not really much else to add here. We'll see. But yeah, there you go.
Yeah. So yeah, you got that shit going on. And then we had this weird little story. So, President Trump had his name put onto the U.S. Institute of Peace building. Only one problem, that building is not owned by the government.
Yeah, they're not a government, part of the government. They're an independent, organization. But yeah, he's had his name put up. Ahead of what is it? They got something there, some event they're doing there. I'm trying to see where it says here what it's ahead of. Yeah, an agreement they had. Yeah, peace agreement they were signing on Thursday between Congo's President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwanda's President Paul Kagame. And high-ranking officials from the African Union, Angola, Burundi, Kenya, Togo, Qatar, Uganda, and the United Arab Emirates are also expected to attend the signing. But yeah, this obviously ridiculous considering they don't own the building or any of that. So hopefully when he is out of office, I would not be surprised if he tries to do more. Let's just put his name on all these buildings. Just have the next guy just fucking take them all off because they're stupid as fuck.
Yeah. So yeah, just really stupid shit. Speaking of stupid shit, he got the also got the FIFA Peace Prize,
Yeah.
which if you actually look at the trophy itself, like that doesn't look like peace to me. It looks like a
Yeah.
that looks like something symbolizing a zombie takeover.
There is a people on that I've seen likening it to the cover of some racist book. I'm trying to see if I can find specific reference for it. But yeah, it is a weird whole thing. He also got a medal for it that I've never seen him so happy to be getting any sort of award here for this. And this is literally just them trying to appease this giant man baby as he put on the medal and talked to them about the award here. And it's just shows how pathetic he is, person. So yeah, that's a fun whole thing. So yeah, he's managed to turn this potentially cool FIFA World Cup event into something that many people don't have any interest in now because it's tainted by his bullshit. I think Gavin Newsom put up a joke that he won the Coles Peace Prize. I was like, man, imagine this guy wasn't a fucking idiot. We could be talking about him potentially being the next president, but he's an asshole, so fuck him. So yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Okay, I got that. And now we go on to from there to over to this little story. Sadly, as everybody knows, friend star Matthew Perry passed away from a ketamine overdose sometime back. And we now have the news that the doctor that supplied him with it has officially been sentenced to 30 months in prison.
Finally got his sentencing here. And yeah, not really too much of a surprise. Apparently apologized to Matthew Perry's family before the sentence was read in court, admitting he violated his oath to care for the actor. I failed Mr. Perry. I failed his family. I should have protected him. Yeah, he pleaded guilty in July to 4 counts of ketamine distribution, though he did not provide the fatal dose. He was handcuffed and taken into custody by federal marshals. Prosecutors asked for 3 years in prison. Defense asked that he be sentenced to probation. The judge rejected the defense arguments that he initially intended to treat Perry's depression. So yeah, there you go. Sad news, but he's getting his just punishment, so
Yeah.
there you go.
And after that, we now move on to the entertainment portion of the show. And our first big entertainment story for the night, after a couple of months being up for auction, we now know who has officially managed to win the bidding war to get Warner Brothers with $82.7 billion. Netflix has officially acquired, well, I don't know if they've.
They're finishing the deal finally, send it to you.
Yeah, they're working on it. But yep, they won the bidding war.
Yeah. Which is probably the best option here. Maybe NBC Universal would have been a better option, but they seem to always be out of alignment with any of these deals that have been going on, because I think they were also trying to get Disney, Fox, and some of these other companies. And always just never fall for it, but if they have to be sold off to somebody, they're definitely better than Paramount Skydance, who still David Ellison there still seems to be like, we're still going to push ahead and try to acquire in sort of a hostile manner, like I guess acquire all the stock instead of going through a pure acquisition sort of thing, which leaves a lot of questions still about how everything's going to work. What do you do with HBO Max and all that? Because Netflix is basically getting everything but the Discovery side of the company, and their media news media stuff, so CNN and all that's not coming over. I think they put up a big graphic there, you know, getting DC. They're getting all the movie stuff, all the TV stuff. I don't know about any, like, what is it, any of the channels or anything. But they're also going to be getting the Warner Brothers games division. So Mortal Kombat and all that will be under Netflix's umbrella, which is probably better for them to get sort of existing studios, because the times they've tried to set up their own big tentpole studio never really goes well for that. So yeah, it's like I'd prefer there not to have to be an acquisition of this kind. But these Warner Brothers Discovery was kind of setting themselves up for that happening eventually, because they were, you know, spinning off the two parts of the company that would, you know, necessitate that they would sell that off at some point. But the Paramount Skydance, essentially after they acquired, you know, merged Paramount and Skydance, they're like, we're going after Warner Brothers Discovery, and that just forced this all to happen rapidly like this. So that's the place we're in. Netflix seems to be fine with still doing the theater experiences, but you see some of the things going on out there, and people are like, oh, it's the end of Hollywood and all that. It's like, I don't know about that. That seems a bit overreacting to all this. We'll have to see where all this goes, because it still has to go through, you know, government approval and all that. And so there's the notion that Trump might try to sour this and find some way to get Paramount to be the acquisition partner for this, which would be the worst of all outcomes here for that. But yeah, that's kind of where this is going. And I'd also say Netflix at least is going to be better than Warner Brothers Discovery, because they're not going to remove content the way that Zaslav did, getting rid of, you know, various HBO shows and Cartoon Network stuff, and the Coyote versus Acme, like shut down movies and all this, and refuse to let them to be shown despite paying for everything up to the point of putting it in theaters kind of stuff. So it seems like possibly the best option out of here, but we won't see it finalized until probably next summer. And then where that goes from there, like whether Netflix is going to essentially ingest the HBO Max content, or if they're going to keep those as separate apps or anything like that. And it's like, I probably would see Netflix ingest all the HBO stuff and just become a bigger app that they could charge more for all the added content to it. We'll see where all that goes, but for now, that's kind of where it's going. Again, Netflix sent out emails, I think, either late last night or early this morning. It was like about the acquisition, saying nothing's going to change right now about HBO Max and Netflix and all that. So we'll see where that all goes. But yeah, there you go.
Like I said, it's going to be causing some shit over the next few months, and we already have some issues because a bunch of A-listers who are, you know, wishing to remain anonymous are apparently lobbying Congress against the deal.
Yeah. Let's see. The letter was sent via email to members of Congress from both parties on Thursdays from an anonymous collective identifying themselves only as concerned feature film producers. The group explained it was leaving the letter unsigned, and not out of cowardice, but fear of retaliation, given Netflix's considerable power as a buyer and distributor. Which, yeah. Definitely seems like in that vein of like, oh, they're gonna destroy Hollywood and destroy the theater system, and it's like, I don't know that that makes any sense, considering, you know, if Netflix has the ability to make, you know, billions off of these movies in theaters before they go into, you know, whatever streaming service they have, they would probably choose to take that extra money as well. Like, they've basically said they would like to shorten the exclusivity window for theater stuff, but that's maybe that there. Yeah, the producers argued that Netflix would, quote unquote, effectively hold a noose around the theatrical marketplace. Just like, Jesus, guys, calm down. Yeah. So yeah, there you go. That's a thing that happened.
And then, of course, we also know, of course, now that the Writers Guild of America is also openly opposing the deal.
Yeah. Which seems more reasonable considering it's potentially just less work for them. Yeah, saying could potentially eliminate jobs, reduce wages, and raise prices for consumers and all that. So, yeah, the world's largest streaming company swallowing one of its biggest competitors, what antitrust laws were designed to prevent. The outcome would eliminate jobs, push down wages, worse conditions for all entertainment workers, raise prices for consumers, and reduce the volume and diversity of content for all viewers. Industry workers, along with the public, are already impacted by only a few powerful companies maintaining tight control over what consumers can watch on television, on streaming, and in theaters. This merger must be blocked. At least that is more of a reasonable argument to put forward. Also, you have Netflix not being one of the major studios. So, versus, you know, Paramount or NBC, Universal, those are two of the other major studios. That would be the same kind of thing, I would assume, if they would be arguing against if it went either of those ways. But yeah, them saying this is what antitrust laws are for, and it's like, yeah, but not in this administration. So we'll see where that goes. But yeah, there you go.
But yeah, with that we move on to some other stuff. We got, for example, Men in Black 5. Yes, you heard me correctly. 5 is officially in the works at Sony.
That seems to be a thing they want to do. Sony has tapped Chris Bremner, the writer of the recent Bad Boys movies, which were all pretty good, to draft a script for the fifth film in the Men in Black franchise. So the idea of, you know, any of the people from the original movies or the most recent one would be coming back for this. Is it still pretty early at this point? But yeah, that could be all right. I don't know. It would be fun to see Will Smith return for this, because I think at this point he's not too good for that. Especially if he could be the older guy grooming somebody new to take over. You know what Tommy Lee Jones was in the original.
Yeah, so there's that. And we also found out this week that Vin Diesel is both writing and starring in a Rock 'em Sock 'em Robots movie.
Boy, that's a property I don't know that needed to exist, but Barbie worked, so why not try this? At least it could be an interesting movie, because what was the robot fighting movie from whatever, like 10 years ago, I think it was, with the kid and the dad. I forget what that one's called. You could potentially do something similar to that, but I don't know. Weird one.
Yeah, it's a weird one. It really depends.
Might as well just do like a Stretch Armstrong movie and more stupid shit like that.
And then this really funny story. So HBO Max put out a 4K remaster of Mad Men. Turns out the one they put out was the unedited version.
Yeah.
And by unedited, I mean that.
You can see crew on the sides of the shots. And like the one shot that's infamously being shared around is the vomit scene, where you can see the tube being fed into it, from the crew on the sideline. So yeah, this was the version at Lionsgate. Just sent them the wrong version, I assume. So yeah, as people went to start watching it on Monday, noticed that this seemed to be missing a lot of the good editing from that they expected from the the previous versions and all that. And it's like, oh yeah, no, this there's something weird going on here. This seems to not be the final version. And it's like,
Exactly.
is he to admit like, oh yep, this is not what should have been out. Yeah, some episodes were mislabeled, which have been fixed at least. But yeah, the edited episode's not been uploaded, so you can still see all that stuff. I forget what site it was. Somebody found the guy that feeding the vomit machine and sort of talking about the invisible parts of these scenes that you don't show, for obvious reasons, sort of all the work that goes into making those kind of things work, that are just more than just the actors doing their scenes, and all that. And it's like, yeah, that's cool angle to take on that. So yeah, there you go.
And last but not least, we got a teaser trailer for The Burbs.
They're doing a new version of this on Peacock. It's a series starting February 8th. Yeah, set in present day suburbia, The Burbs follows a young couple returning to the husband's childhood home. The world is upended when new neighbors move in next door, bringing old secrets of the cul-de-sac to light, and new deadly threats shatter the illusion of their quiet little neighborhood. So like a more modern version of what The Burbs was, which is like, oh, these weird people seem to have moved into this spooky looking house, and they get sort of very conspiracy pilled into thinking like, oh, there's something weird going on here. This has got to be illegal. We need to figure this out. And sort of definitely a fun early Tom Hanks movie. So yeah, that could be good. I don't know.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Pretty solid, especially in this day and age where neighbors don't often talk to each other much anymore. As much as they did when the original movie came out. So yeah, that could be fun.
With that, we officially have ourselves a show, folks. Yes, we do. We have got ourselves a show. So, if you would, all of those listening out there, if you would like to send us a question, comment, or have us something read on the air, you can get in contact with us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We got a link for it in the show notes. Also, on top of Apple Podcasts, you can catch our little bit of unscripted shenanigans at TuneIn, RSS, or basically any kind of podcast aggregator you can think of. And if we're not on there, just give it a few minutes. We will be eventually. But yeah, we're going to go ahead and wind it all down here. Thank you again, Chris, for joining me on this little endeavor. All of you out there listening, whether you're a new listener just discovering us for the first time, or you are a veteran listener who's been with us since the early days of the show, which I think at this point might be almost, God, we've been doing this show for a long ass time now, haven't we? Damn. Either way, if you like what you hear, please do not hesitate to share us with your friends, your family, your casual acquaintances, your mortal enemies, and everyone in between, because they may hate you, but there's a good 50-50 chance they'll like us, and that's something we can all benefit from, I think. I don't really know how fractions work. But yeah, we're going to go ahead and end it here. I have been your host for the most, Brandon Perkins. Tune in next week, where it'll probably still be freezing, and we will probably still be trying to keep warm, and we'll probably still have more crazy shit to talk about as Christmas starts coming in closer and closer. And, oh yeah, don't forget, pretty sure we got the Game Awards next week too, don't we?
Yeah.
We do, so that's also going to be a thing. Keep on the lookout for that. Good night, everybody.